Okay, I'd like to call to order the meeting of the UTEMCO Board of Directors. The date is October 15th, 2015, and the time is now 11:02. I think our first order of business is we have some nice presents to pass out for our new board members. Chancellor McRaven, thank you very much. Bruce tells me that this is the only thing that you'll get out of your board membership here, but thank you very much for being on the board. We look forward to your involvement. Dave Beck, thank you very much for your participation as well. And then finally, Phil Adams. Phil, thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
And these do not need to return.
Here, let's give them a round of applause. Thank you for your service. All right. The first item on the agenda for discussion and appropriate action is the minutes of April 22nd, 2015 meeting. Are there any comments or changes to the minutes? All right. Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. The next item relates to UTEMCO Board Committee assignments. I move the appointment of Director Beck to the Audit and Ethics Committee, subject to the approval by the Board of Regents, the University of Texas System, and the Policy Committee. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Resolution is approved. The next three items on the agenda do not require any board action. Bruce, could you please take us through the endowment and operating funds update?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll look to be brief since we got a late start. In your paper copy, tab 3, if you turn to kind of the second page, this is page 15 in Diligent. This is our dashboard. As you can see, it's flashing fairly green. Scenarios will never be green because we always look at downside. And volatility will never be green because, again, we look at negative scenarios for the most part. And volatility, we always focus on the downside. On the next page, just a level set, at the end of August, we were running $35.2 billion, half in the Permanent University Fund, another $8.2 in the General Endowment Fund, which is $1.1 of the Permanent Health Fund and $7.1 of the Long-Term Fund. We had $7 billion in the intermediate fund and most of the rest in the short-term fund. If you flip to page 5, 18 in Diligent, these are our returns for the Permanent University Fund, General Endowment Fund, and Intermediate-Term Fund. So for the fiscal year that just ended, we earned 43 basis points in the PUF, 1.08% in the JEF. I'm on page 5. Behind tab 3 or page 18 in Diligent. So the weighted average of the endowment returns were 60 basis points. We did have a loss in the intermediate term fund. Over the last 3 and 5 years, we've earned an average of more than 8% in the endowments, 6.2% over 10 years because it included the Great Recession. Some numbers you don't have on your page, but which I think note is for the calendar year ending September. We closed our books on September. So for the 9 months of the calendar year, the endowments were down 0.25%, which is, we don't like to be down, but I would point out that the public equity markets, the U.S. stock market was down 5%, and global equity markets are down 7%. So we've been saying for a number of years that we wouldn't keep up in bull markets. Good on that, but we also suggested that we protect the downside, and at least so far this calendar year, we've been doing that.
Bruce, yes. These are nominal returns?
Yes.
These are all nominal.
After all expenses, so nominal returns.
Real plus inflation, right, minus fees, equals yes. Last 10 years, 6.25%.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. And inflation over that period of time has been what?
Probably about two.
Two?
I'd have to.
Probably. It might be, in the future, more specificity around what it really is.
Yep.
Okay. The next page is just kind of a heat map that shows where the returns have come from. And so we show MCC, which is our jargon for long only, LCC, hedge funds, and private investments across the bottom, and then the different asset classes from top to bottom. And you can see that the returns came primarily in our private equity, the strong green. The hedge fund book was up. The main part of it was up 4.6%. And again, equities, developed country equities, long only book were also up in the 4.9% range. It was a tough year for natural resources and for emerging markets and for bonds. The next page shows longer term trends. Up at the top, as you can see, that green line is just the S&P 500, and you see the steep drop at the bottom. You see the steep drop at the far right. It's still slightly above the UTIMCO returns, but again, as we pointed out in previous meetings, we've seen that before. We saw that in the tech bubble of 2000. Even during the bull market of 2007, the endowments had enough steam, but as you see, they didn't drop as much. So, and clearly, our returns would beat the 60-40 in an all-bond portfolio. Let me skip to page 10, 23 in Diligent, because I think this is kind of interesting. If you look over on the right, the bars represent different asset classes. So the purple bars are different bonds, the global ag, the TIPS or inflation or real bonds, and then the high yield. We're all down. The grays are the commodities. We emphasize oil and gold. They were down. On the right, the orange are the emerging markets. And other than China, they were all down. China was up 38.5%. Japan, the topics, was up 3.2%. And the S&P over this period of time was up 0.5%. As I mentioned, we were up 0.6%. So in the face of, I think, some fairly strong headwinds, we were able to generate at least positive returns. The next page, again, shows the up-down capture, which, as we pointed out, in up markets, we tend to, our returns are about two-thirds of the equity markets, but in the down markets, it's only been 36 to 40% of the down. If we go to page 19,
Bruce, would you maybe just for perspective, relative to peers, I know there's been a lot of talk recently about Harvard changing its model.
Yep.
Give us a sense of what their up-down capture would be, because this is a
we don't know. We don't have monthly returns on peers. We have quarterly returns for some peers, but not others.
Harvard and Yale probably being outside that set.
Right, the ones you most want quarterly return from, they don't give it to Cambridge. So we just don't have this. We engaged Cambridge about 5 or 6 years ago to try to do some analysis on volatility-adjusted or risk-adjusted returns in that capture. And, we paid them. They gave us something. But if you don't have the data, you don't have the data.
But, of course, this is the heart of the discussion is risk-adjusted returns. And so, however you can present this, I think, in clear, succinct fashion, this is how are we doing relative to policy? How are we doing relative to peers? Because it's what the board of regents wants as well, risk-adjusted returns.
Yes, yes, sir.
Okay.
And so that up-down capture is how we try to show it. We'll keep working on it. Saying getting it relative to peers, risk adjusted to peers, up down capture to peers, they won't give us the data. They won't give us the data.
No way to get it, Chair Key?
No, Nikubo is a trade organization that collects that. It's voluntarily submitted by about 800 endowments around.
By the way, all they collect are returns and assets. Because it's the common fund.
Nikubo.
I'm on the board of that organization.
And it's annual. It's self-reported, and as Bruce says, it's a subset, and you can get access to that data, but they won't allow you to link
that
which endowment the data's coming from, you sort of get it in aggregate.
That's the Nakubo. Yeah. Cambridge has had better data, but still
it's
not
subset.
Good. Yeah. And again, I can't get it here. The Cambridge can't get it out here right here. They can just show us versus the total of what they get being a subset of what we can serve surely one.
But you can get sharp ratios and
you've
right?
got to have the monthly return numbers, and we don't get monthly return. The best you get is quarterly for some.
I've done some research that looks at that
right.
over time, but with annual data. And
anyway, not the time, but we need, this is, I think, a big push that we need to look at. This risk-adjusted returns, how do we compare to others? What are our peers doing? Because in the absolute, negative 1.5, negative 3.75, that doesn't mean a lot to them. In absolute form, but on a relative basis, it does. Go ahead.
Okay. Page 19 in your paper copies, page 32 in the value add page. We don't have the private investment benchmark yet. We won't get that for another couple weeks. So we don't know how we've ended the year on value add. For just the long only and the hedge fund books, for the 1 year, it looks good. 236 basis points, $550 million. We'll find out whether we beat or lag the private investment benchmarks in a few weeks. Over longer periods of time, we've been in that 140, 147 range, which has been about $350 million a year value add. But I'd like to give you more information. I don't have it. I would next move to page 23, our allocation. In diligent, I'm sorry, 36. Page 36. We are overweight private investments by a little over 2%. As you know, that's a real, we can't really control that because we get capital calls and we get distributions from our partners. We don't control that. And so that the source of funds has to come from somewhere. But if you go to the next page, page 24 in paper 37, that overweight in private investments in developed country has been offset by our underweight in public equity developed country, and the emerging market overweight in privates has also been offset. So really the main area we're underweight right now is real estate and to some extent natural resources. And by the way, the underweight in real estate is we've gotten some tremendous distributions. So, it hadn't been because the book didn't perform. We just got a lot of cash back, which we think we're happy to get in the current environment. The next page is we don't really have much left in the way of hedges. It's a low cost, so we just haven't done much recently. Let me flip to page 30. Paper 43 on diligent. This is our asset allocation for the endowments. Top left, we have $1.5 billion, 6.1% in the mattress, long only investment grade fixed income. Our credit book is down to about $2 billion as the private investments begin to pay back and the hedge funds begin to distribute money. Our total real estate exposure, about $1.9 billion, 7.2%. Two-thirds of that's in the private book. One-third is in the public book. Our natural resources, which, again, is the full spectrum of natural resources, energy, metals, manufacturing, agriculture, is up to 13.8%. A little over half of that's in the private book. The other $1.6 billion, 6.4%, is fairly evenly split between broad commodities, gold, and natural resources-related public equity. We continue to have about 63% of our assets in equities, 48.5% in developed country, 14.7% in emerging markets. So in the long-only public equity book, $3.5 billion of the endowments are in developed countries, $2.4 billion in emerging markets. We're up to about just under $1 billion in emerging market private equity. So down at the bottom, we're up to 32% in private investments, right below, we're 29.9 in hedge funds and 38% in the long only book. Let me flip to page 37 in paper, page 50 in diligence. When we look at our liquidity, we talked about this a little earlier in the policy committee. The blue line is illiquidity in 3 months. So we're up to 64% of illiquidity in 3 months, or 36% of liquidity. That yellow line is the trigger point where if our illiquidity goes above that, staff no longer has delegated authority to make new commitments. Or you do, we'll come to you if we reach that trigger and if we feel like we should want to make private investment commitments, we'll come to you. Over on the right are unfunded commitments. We have $6.4 billion of unfunded commitments. It's up to just under 25%. You can see the tick up. It was at 20% a year ago. We were projecting that number to be at 21.7%. The reason why it's at 24.9% and not 21.7% is primarily what we call the denominator effect. That projection was based on earning about 7% this year. Well, we didn't. We earned 60 basis points. And so when the denominator is lower, and we were pretty close on the numerator in terms of dollars, the percentage went up. We were slightly higher on the numerator. In the hedge fund book, we made a commitment to a new fund who will call the capital over time. They've limited the amount of money they'll take up front. We had a $3.1 billion target for private investment commitments. We made $3.2 billion. Slightly over our target, but not much, and that's really it. The main reason why that jumped up is because the endowment's returns were lower than projected for the last 12 months. We're not good at one-year projections, not great at one-year projections. We have a ceiling here of 30%, so if unfunded commitments go up to 30%, then again, the same thing, staff no longer has delegated authority to make investment commitments, we would come to you if we wanted to do something.
In that vein, so over on page 13 in the paper is our scenario analysis, our stress test.
Yes, sir. Oh, I meant to turn it over to Uzi. Sorry.
Am I doing Uzi's part?
I forgot to ask Uzi to do his part.
At any rate, only comment there related to the offline discussion at earlier today, some of the, I think, healthy discussion is making sure the client understands drawdowns.
Yes, sir.
Here. That's, I think, important. We've had it voiced before that that's not accepted. So that's something to socialize, I think, with the client. And in that vein, as we look at liquidity, there's a discussion about increasing expected returns by getting exposure to private equity. In that vein, I think we should make sure we've got a lot of scenario analysis just on liquidity, meaning the perfect storm. By the way, we've done this before. You keep it not in the book, it's in a file that can be printed out. But the scenario analysis, meaning drawdown coupled with we try to redeem and somebody won't give us our money back, distribution stop coming in, but yet they keep calling capital from us. All that together, I think, ought to be looked at as we get sort of at the tip of the whip on the liquidity analysis.
Yes, sir.
Something I know we do, but
I just. You've done it, we'll look to keep doing it. I get very little time at the Regents Finance Committee meeting, so I'll have to figure out ways to communicate well to our client. In writing, I'll communicate to them.
As we know from past experience, the marks you get can create some interesting misalignment versus policy in the asset.
Okay. And Uzi, I apologize. I know we're way behind. We're pretty much on our volatility target. Your attention to the scenario, so I think we covered the high points. Peyton.
And before I just point on the big process, some scenarios have been contagious when something happens either in the U.S. or China and other markets react to that. that there's a difference between the short term and the long term, which is also important. I mean, if you look at the client, some of the big scenarios, the big drawdowns, the dramatic ones, might have a strong recovery. Actually, the not very interesting, the low gradual ones that have the kind of low returns for a very long time, that might be saying no, that's not so very different types of scenarios. One is more dramatic, and
I think these are viewed as stress tests or shocks, drawdowns. What we've talked about for years is, hey, what about just a grinding, boring bear market that goes on for a while, which most people working today don't know much about, right? Unless we're old, gray-haired, or bald, or whatever. So there are bear markets, and if we ever have one, that's actually not reflected in here quite as much. These are drawdowns, but I think the liquidity issue, I know you guys look at closely.
And you know, I apologize because we had done some work on a bear market, but I think we had that for the July meeting, which we ended up not having. So I forgot to put it in this book. So I'm not sure. I think we shared it with the risk committee, but I'm not sure we shared it with the whole board because we had looked at that bear market. And, you know, it will, it's not happening.
It's on page 134 of the agenda. In the presentation for adjusting
strategy. Oh, there you go.
We'll get to that.
Well, no. This was part of the policy. I wasn't going to get to that, so because it was part of the policy that the presentation we put together for that. But if you're behind in paper, tab 8, page 21. Thank you. You did the work. Why don't you speak to me? Page 134, diligent.
As our business is kind of long bear markets. The 70s one example of driven a lot by high inflation and returns were low for a very long time. Grinding steadily down is one way, but even then, on the 70s, we had a down shot, then something almost normal, and then another down shot. But overall, if you look over a 10-year period, I think a 1.7% average loss, and that's before distribution. So even in such a scenario, making zero distribution would have eaten into the corpus and definitely was protecting distribution. This scenario has eating into the corpus. That's just a different way to look at it. On the very next slide is by almost nowhere to buy. So we try to work with a diversified portfolio with some. The thought is one asset class might work when another doesn't work, but the scenario gold was the only thing that was positive in some sense, and commodities in this specific market were up. A big part of what was driving the low return was the oil embargo. Not necessarily a typical bear market, but no
place to buy for 10 years. Now, the CIO at Cambridge University in the UK one time told me that her boss told her they've had good centuries and bad centuries.
But look, this is an important point. Page 135 is 10-year period of time. Your policy returns would have been negative 1.7.
Correct.
And with a 4.5% distribution on top of that, you've got a third less in value of the corpus at the end of 10 years.
Yes.
So we just all need to understand that we will have drawn down, in that scenario, we would have drawn down the puff by a third.
Yes, sir.
So speaks to what a bear market looks like. Our distribution number, the right number. If it's the needed number, then we just need to communicate with the client. The drawdowns and the grind down, I would call it. But we can take less risk by just buying a bunch of bonds, maybe the German bond today, which I think is a negative yield.
Okay.
Buy a bunch of that.
Well, and what this would say is we should put it all in gold.
Yeah.
If this is our base case, we should put it all in gold.
long-term bear market.
You're not going to earn anything on gold, and so you're not going to make 5%. You got to decide.
But the other point that we talked about this morning, we've got to have a long-term perspective, because over 10, we're down negative 1.4, 1.7, but in periods, we were down 29%, 20%, 29%. So, single-year events, we were down 30%. So we've got to manage this with a long-term perspective, I think. And so
I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but in terms of the simulations, are we rebalancing every year, or do you just stay steady and let the market grind you down?
That's
a good point. What do you do?
Rebalancing every year.
You did?
The simulation.
Will you talk about the simulation on page 130? And when you think about a debt-led inflationary environment, which one might say is most likely in the next 10 years, if it were to happen, says that falling growth, falling inflation is the best investment environment. So I'd like to understand your inputs and your outputs here.
Basically, what we're looking at in the four pages of the four scenarios between page 129 and 130, is sort of the return of the different assets. Falling inflation being defined as current inflation less than the 10-year average, so it could be currently rising but from a low rate. So if it goes up this year, for example, from a 0.2 where it's now to a 0.5, but the 10-year average was 1.8, that's what we call it. Falling inflation or inflation lower than the 10-year average, growth versus 10-year average. And these four WCS, I agree with you that they are surprising. And the expectation going into it is that the rising growth, falling inflation would be the best. This inflationary environment, this is what the numbers tell. It's not necessarily intuitive and therefore not necessarily what the that one, the falling growth coupled with rising inflation, which loses 4% in real terms every year, and that happens 21% of the time. That on the other side. If you look at the two falling inflation combined, so if low inflation tends to be good and bad inflation, and high inflation tends to be bad, so just the average of because they were very similar on the real returns, you're above 6% real returns on the falling inflation, but you're losing above 1% a year in an environment of rising.
So I hear you. I'd like to see your probability analysis of just like this on page 130 with a nominal deflationary environment. Says falling growth, falling inflation. I'd love to see a falling growth, nominal deflation page. And I think the client should have a look at that too.
I'm not sure how much you have
I mean, we haven't had global rates at zero almost ever, so you're going to have to use your imagination a little bit. Maybe look to Japan for the last 20 years and have a come up with your own view as to what it looks like.
Thank you. Good. Okay, now for the more interesting part of the funds update, starting on page 46 in tab 3, page 59. This is just a little chart where we look at individual portfolios, and along the horizontal axis, were they positive or were they negative? So look on the far right, our venture capital portfolio returned 51% this past year. 51%. The vertical axis is whether the portfolio outperformed or underperformed the at-market average. And so you see that the two blue circles on the top, the developed long-only developed country and emerging markets, substantially outperformed the market average. And then the green, I mentioned we don't have our private investment benchmarks yet, so we've just kept them where they are. But what I'd like to do now is have the senior
investment officers quickly take you through their books, starting with Russ Campy and the MCC Investment Grade Fixed Income.
It's interesting to read 47 paper and 16 million. Personal summary page for I'd like to point out that the left hand chart value add for 1, 3, and 5 years, 1 year, well, this point does only up 10 basis points. Last quarter, that's what you're particularly disappointing for us. We gave up 170 basis points to Alpha in that quarter due to adverse FX movements. Markets still had slightly positive results for the year, but that's not that hasn't been our standard as you can see from the last 3 years. Moving down below, we always like to get risk for return. Portfolio information ratio for the year was 0.1 as well. You can see in 3 and 5 years, 0.8 and 0.9 or more along the lines of what we'd like to see over time. Finally, if you look at the right side, the pie chart, those percentages between our managers and take up the portfolio have been fairly stable. Move to page 48, page 61, upper left-hand corner, overview, modified duration of the portfolio for interest rates and risk, right in line with the index, yield maturity below that. And our agency rating is one notch below the index, so we're fairly well in line there as well. Moving to the right-hand upper box, I point out our overweight in the United States within the overall portfolio, matched off almost exactly with the United States and Europe, post the low rates. Highlighted by overweights to Mexico, 4.9%, Brazil, 4.9%, South Africa, 8%. And finally, you have a decent sized underweight to Asia Pacific. That 6.6% underweight actually masks a larger underweight to Japan of 13.2% versus the U.S. If you go to the bottom, markets 11.4%. Primarily, that's overweight in Mexico, 3.8%, and approximately 1.5% overweight in Chile, South Africa, Brazil, India. And finally, if you look at the sector exposure chart on the lower right hand side, you see that we are overweight to treasuries and sovereigns by 12.3%, and that's offset by a 7% underweight to government-related and securitized. Those have been fairly steady, particularly securitized. The Federal Reserve holdings in the mortgage market have made that market fairly richly priced in equity. So probably won't get these until hopefully next year. They might stop reinvesting that market.
Question on a five-year basis. Value add and portfolio information ratio to be in the upper quartile of managers. What do you think those numbers would be in terms of value add and portfolio information?
I think if you look at that on a 5-year basis, we'd be fairly close to the upper quartile.
Okay. So you think upper quartiles plus or minus 150 basis points of outperform?
Yes.
And the Sharpe ratio of 0.9?
Information.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Just as a rule of thumb, like an information ratio of 0.5 would be really good.
Okay.
That probably gets you right around the top quartile, if not firmly.
And Jeff, we target, when we look at our managers, we target 0.5. We obviously want to do better than 0.5, and we have over time. But that's sort of our standard.
Okay.
This is the point.
So 5 years, you give yourself an A, A minus? No, how about you? What you
I'm going to defer to my boss. No.
What's your grade? You think this is an A minus in terms of fixed income?
I think it's an A.
A? Okay. Good.
And we came up probably the most difficult quarter that we've had since we've been in charge of that portfolio.
Okay. Nice job.
You're not going to ask board members to grade ourselves.
Mark Warner, Natural Resources.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
we have really two things to talk about here, the commodity portfolio and the natural resources equity portfolio. Let's start with the commodity portfolio. A couple years ago, we anticipated that there was going to be a really big structural change in the commodity world. And so we went from what I call kind of version 1.0 of this portfolio, which was strategies that were pretty constrained around our benchmark to strategies that were much less constrained. And then we migrated on to Wellington's platform with two strategies. These are both much less constrained than what it had, what we had previously. So we sort of anticipated this dislocation, not to this effect. So as you can see, just broad commodities have been down 7% over 5 years, 15% over three, 28% over the last year. What is disappointing to us is that these strategies were designed to outperform even in this sort of drawdown on a relative basis. The fiscal year, they have not. In previous fiscal years, they have. This last fiscal year, almost corresponding exactly to the fiscal year, our strategies have entered a really difficult period of performance. And what I would say is where we stand just on a macro basis is if you look across broad commodities, you know, all the metals, the energy, the ags, the commodities are trading at about 0.85 of what their marginal cost to produce them is. That means every incremental unit, you're only getting 85% of your cost realized from current spot prices. And so what has happened is the whole sector has overcorrected, which is not uncommon. It tends to overcorrect to the downside, overcorrect to the upside. We're in a downside overcorrection. For our strategies, the allocation across sectors was the single biggest detractor. We were overweight energy going into what happened last fall. We were overweight but deferred. So our partner had a view that oil in December and January, December 14, January 15, was cheap, relatively speaking. We were overweight those contracts. Oil came off very rapidly. By being deferred, it cushioned the blow a bit, but we were still overweight, and that was a huge detractor from performance relative to the index. We were also overweight the platinum group metals, and what happened there was a classic thing that's happening across the whole sector, and that is cost deflation. So what's happened is costs have come down as prices have come down, so that price to marginal cost equation has been dynamic. I think our partner got some of their math wrong on their price to marginal cost, and they were looking at contracts in platinum they thought had value. Well, what happened was the South African rand, where most of the platinum and palladium in the world are produced, went down 50%. And in local currency terms, they could still afford to produce, even though they had a really bad commodity price. And so overweight energy, overweight platinum group metals, underweight agriculture, those big sector bets in this discretionary strategy was what cost us relative to performance. And finally, I think, as we all know, currency has just been a huge hit on commodities. You know, have almost no chance to outperform on a dollar basis when the dollar is as strong as it is. So what I would say is going forward, we've got a multidisciplinary team at Utimco, not just us, but Kate from Risk, Courtney from the hedge fund group, all engaging on these strategies very closely through this fiscal year to really watch if they're doing what they should do, and if they don't, we'll take a decision.
And we're going to spend a little more time on currency. It's been a big deal, obviously, for the resources, but also emerging markets.
Mark, remind us what the benchmark is here.
It's the. It used to be called the Dow, Dow Joe GBS. It's now called the Bloomberg Commodity Index. They basically bought the index, so Bloomberg now is the commodity index.
Is there an ETF based on that?
I suspect there is. It's the most widely accepted index, so it's approximately 30 commodities. Flipping to page 50, which is 62 in Diligent, on the natural resources equity book, it's a similar story, but what I would say is different reasons. The book has underperformed significantly this year after having outperformance in previous fiscal years. This is actually not unexpected. So this is a long-only equity book that is very high growth and lower market cap relative to our benchmark. We believe that over a cycle, that will outperform. It will not outperform during a drawdown. And so we are experiencing sort of the maximum negative effects of having that portfolio strategy. What I will tell you is, and you know, I suspect folks around the table have a view on this, but our view is that it is really near capitulation in the equity markets, that over the past 5 months, natural resources equities have come down 30% since May. That's after a brutal 2014 and a very difficult early 2015. So we believe things have traded well through their value in a lot of cases, and our book feels the effect of that. What I would say is about half of the underperformance is from one single position, and that is we are underweight Exxon, and we are overweight a bunch of smaller, high-growth oil and gas companies. So, you know, over time, we believe those companies are going to have much bigger growth and much better results than ExxonMobil, but not through a big drawdown like this. And so while we're not happy with these numbers are actually consistent with the characteristics of the portfolio. What I think we should say, where I will judge the results is when the market trades back to a more normal valuation scenario. When we look at how much of the ups we capture, we compare that across the cycle. I believe we will have made significant alpha. Our beta to the index is about 1.2, which means we should expect at least 20% more of the outperformance on the way up. What I would say too is this is a long only portfolio, so we don't. While we can certainly underweight it, our partners don't have a lot of places to go. They are long only, and they have defined universes of equities. If you think of our broad equity book, which Susan and Amanda will be speaking to, where their partners and their strategies have the ability to go in and out of sectors, they realized a significant amount of their outperformance by being out of these sectors. And that's on a much bigger capital base. So what I would say to you is overall, from an endowment perspective, this pullback in the energy equities and mining equities and commodity-related equities has been actually a net contributor across the broader equity book. So in places where we were able to be out of the sector, that was a big contributor.
Is the benchmark long only?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Well, Jeff, I'm waiting for Jeff to ask me the grade. What I would say. Well, if we're going to base it on a year, it's an F. If there's an F minus. Yeah, well, I appreciate that. But the numbers are what they are. But I want to put it in perspective what's going on in both of those portfolios.
I would ask one, what's Exxon down in the last year?
I'd be just guessing off the top of my head, but I'd guess 15, 20%.
And you're down 43%.
Yep.
So, bet on Exxon and maybe not on the others. But
well, Jeff, you know as well as I do, if you could time that perfectly, it'd be great. The reality is over time, I think you would take a well-managed mid-cap energy company growing to 20% annually over Exxon. I think that those equities will outperform. But I think the time to really judge is let's look back and see how much of the ups we get. If we didn't get paid for this trough, then those strategies didn't work. In 08 or 09, we did. We realized a similar drawdown on the way back up. We made a lot more money than the index.
Do you like your tracking?
It is not as high as you think. I can't remember James. If we have, I don't remember where James is. I would say it's about. Let me give you the exact number because we did it in our summary. You know, I can't remember, but it's relatively high. I mean, consistent with the beta 1.2.
4 or 5.
Yeah, I think it's probably 5 or 6.
Probably more like 7.
Yeah, it's high.
Okay.
It's high because the names we own are significantly off the benchmark names. There's no question about it.
I'd ask the following, maybe come at it a little bit different. So, you know, you're a cornerback, you get beat on a big play, it doesn't go very good, but if you're a good cornerback, you're ready and might win the game on the next. If we're going to be in this space, you know, are we now on a percentage of assets allocated with the markdowns below where we want to be? And that would lead to a question of rebalancing while we're down. And it further leads to the issue of, you know, we've got some knowledge of the space. I think you feel like we've got some good partners out there in the private sector. They're in the balance sheet at different opportunistic places, credit. Do we actually need to be, even though I know it's no fun to be down, and it's disheartening for any of them, but assets go down.
Yeah.
Do we need to be going more in to this space in a bigger way right now with prices where they are and making a, you know, a concerted move? There's a lot of money being raised to do that, so that's, but we have a unique seat. We have some pricing power in terms of pricing our capital. And we need, especially in some of the asset-based areas, we actually need to be, instead of waiting for a recovery and kind of being down about the returns, do we need to be getting in pretty aggressively to some of this?
So like,
I don't mean 100% of your Timco's assets. I'm talking about your allocated percentage.
Right. Let me try to be brief and give you an answer. First of all, we have been continuing to rebalance. We've added about $10 million a month for 4 or 5 months earlier this year in the equity book, for example. That has outperformed the benchmark. Those individual rebalance, we look at that as a portfolio just to track how that's doing. It's actually up. I think that will contribute to us capturing the P&L that we've lost when the market turns. On the private side, our private equity book is only down 2.5% in a world where it boils down 50%. Now, I realize that's based on marks, but what I can tell you is we had 2 or 3 really big realizations where the realizations were well in excess of the marks, and that contributed to our performance. And our companies aren't levered, and so we haven't had any big losses in the private equity. It's actually been doing really well. And what's different this time than during the last drawdown is we have a network of partners that are being opportunistic. And, you know, a lot of other institutions see the dislocation. Everybody can see it, and they're scrambling to try to add partners and feel like we're in a really good position. So I think we'll be able to report back to you that we did get a significant amount of money to work during this part of the cycle, particularly on the private side. And I think those are going to be some fantastic investments.
We have $1.9 billion of unfunded commitments in the natural resources space.
Yeah. So our partners are funded.
I'm sorry, $2 billion.
You know, I know everyone's loath to hear this, but I do want to continue to make a point. Is we do have West Texas lands worth $20 billion, depending upon valuations. And so, you know, in many ways, I mean, look, I agree. We're at an all-time low and hope, you know, there is real capitulation in our industry. And I know it as well as anybody. But we do have, you know, another slug of equity, and it's called West Texas Lands. And so as the market rises, clearly the value of that land in that, last year it was $1.2 billion of revenue to us. This year I think it's going to be $500 million. So, I mean, we have a natural hedge in there in many ways. I mean, as the market rises, clearly those. We just need to at least have some caution in terms of a big rebalance here because we have exposure to natural resources and another asset. I know it's not within PUP, but we don't need to have that debate right now.
We don't
now.
Have that debate
okay.
Right
we
now.
Don't. But just caution.
Yeah, I agree. And notwithstanding that, if we're going to be in this space, this book, you just have to ask with a clear head, you know, are we on our toes, leaning forward, going out looking at some of the great opportunities that may exist right now? But it's
right.
You bring up a very sort of metaphysical point above our pay grade here at this board. That's up at your level.
No, if I knew that, I wouldn't be sitting.
Terrific. Thank you. Mark Schoenberg, who leads the real estate team, decided to go actually work town, some of our partners, along with Eddie Lewis. So they left Makun Joshi holding the bag here to talk about real estate.
As of the fiscal year end, the MCC Real Estate Securities book represented about $786 million with 4 managers and 5 strategies. We had them in 2 global mandates, 1 ex-US mandate, and 2 US mandates. They have a slight underweight to the Buff and Jeff, about 20 basis points, and to that we have 30 basis points. We had undertaken a major revamp of this portfolio late last year. and we've turned over more than 50% of this portfolio to newer strategies and mandates. Unfortunately, as the results show, we are still early in the in seeing results from that revamp. Last year was bad in terms of absolute as well as relative returns. The portfolio generated negative 8.6 on an absolute basis and underperformed the benchmark by about 380 basis points. Most of this relative underperformance actually was driven by one of our partners. They are a little more out on the risk curve. They ended up taking some early positions in countries like Brazil, India, and some other countries in Asia. Given what was happening in the macroeconomic environment, unfortunately, the local markets did not perform well during this period in those economies as well as the currencies, and it negatively impacted almost the entire portfolio. Absent that underperformance, all of the rest of our managers have contributed to us, and without that underperformance, all our numbers, 1, 3, 5 years, would have been positive value add with respect to the benchmarks. Brookfield.
And how big is our investment there?
It's about 20% of the 786.
$250 million. They underperform in both the U.S. and the global. So it's about 30%.
Mostly in the global, the U.S. one.
Yeah, it was the global where they, the 150 in the global. They hurt us. And, you know, it was his first year we just moved to.
And we have engaged the manager. We diligenced them quite a bit. We talk to them on a regular basis. Nothing in terms of their strategy has changed. We have seen this in the past. They're early into some of their themes. But we've also seen that after these periods of underperformance, they've come back typically because their thesis is really
sometimes you call it, we refer to it as the Timco curse. When we engage with a partner, they have their worst year ever. We try not to tell them. Okay, public equity.
In terms of portfolio composition, we had one new manager around, concentrated equity product. We also made a co-investment alongside one of our U.S. managers, and we transferred capital across several of our development managers, partly to fund these investments and then partly to reduce the development equity. So we have 13 managers in the portfolio now, as well as 20% U.S., a third global.
Susan, tell us about the co-investment.
The co-invest is with Ashley Capital, which is a very concentrated U.S. manager with about $700 million, and we made a co-investment called Allison Transition, which is a manufacturer of automatic transmission systems for commercial and military vehicles. And the thesis there is some strategy shift. Ashley thinks that they have better
when was that made?
That was made in June, and we co-invested.
Oshay were some guys that spun out of the Atlanta shop.
Next page. Generating return of negative 13% versus negative 23%. About half of the performance by one of our Brazil managers as well as our China manager. The other half came from an overweight to China, which is during fiscal year outperformed the emerging market. An overweight strong relative performance from several of our gem manager. We're also pleased to see that capital in a down market. So in the fourth quarter, August, that was 15% down. With volatility continues to go up along with market volatility. It's also getting higher on an absolute basis as we continue to move by gem managers. Sharp ratio for past fiscal year now negative because absolute return is negative, inflation rate is high. In terms of year to date, new subscription listed there, that was largely funded from
National. Jeff has a question.
No.
Yes.
I'm going to grade you A plus. Really, exceptional job. It's very, very impressive.
Thank you. And you know, again,
Hoffman will
be talking about
currency movement,
but it's definitely a
band.
Great.
Good work. Thank you.
Hedge funds. So Susan had a great year. We had a good year. In an environment where global equities were up 6, global equities were down 6, U.S. high yield was down 3, we were up 3, so we were still able to compound capital, and relative to the benchmark, which is other fund-to-funds constructing portfolios of managers like us, we outperformed by 160 basis points. So it's not as strong as what it's been, but it was still a pretty good. If you go under the surface, during the year, our long-short equity managers were up about 8. And we have a balanced portfolio. So while that's our largest area at about 55%, it's not the entire portfolio. So macro managers were flat, and credit was down about 3, and then the multi-strat and event managers were down about 5. So when you blend all that, you get to the up 3. If you look at the pie chart on the right, you see the allocations to those strategies. And over time, long-short equity has been going up. We expect that to continue, but on the margin, because it's a big allocation. And then multi-strat event and credit are probably going to decline a little. We're adding to some, but as a whole, the opportunity set is kind of a mixed bag. The lower left corner, you see that we were self-funding for the year. We hired, about half that capital into new hire managers. Thunderbird, Immersion, Two Creeks, all out of Ziff. And then the other half went to managers that were largely closed and they're excited to get additional capacity. On the redemptions, we terminated 7 managers for about $900 million of that $1.2 billion. We just found, even though we were with them for a number of years, better opportunities to upgrade, and then the rest was rebalancing about
3%. That's really one of the toughest things you have is when we have partners, it's fine, but having the conviction to go ahead and redeem from them because we think we found better ones.
So on the next slide, we want to get some perspective. So this is 55 in the books and 68 on diligence. on how we think about the performance of the hedge fund portfolio over time. It's $11 billion, the single largest area, largely due to the ITF, where it's a 45% allocation. And so we just, if you all have never seen these next three slides before, and just really want to walk you through it. So if you just look at cumulative, not annualized, but just cumulative, just chain it out, over rolling five-year periods. You start at the beginning in 98, the first five-year period ends fiscal year 03, and then you just roll it forward every year, rolling five-year windows. And you see that our returns in the blue bar keep up or beat equities most of the time. We are hedged, and therefore we do lag at the bull market peaks. We expect that to happen before, it's happening now, however, we think we're rolling off. And so when you compound that out over the 7-year history, a dollar invested is worth just under $4 versus global equities, that's just over $2. So the next slide drills down a little further in how we think about that skew over time. So now we're talking 1-year period instead of 5-year. And Arden, this kind of addresses during different market environments how we think about performance. So we just kind of said, you know, if you take a bull market north of 10% and a bear market, you know, where some people define it as down 20, but we just said everything down 10 or worse, how do we do? And so the amount of losses in the down periods where the market is down about 28% on average over 153 of these rolling one-year windows, so a ton of data, right? 150 years. The market's down 28% on average, and we're down 9% on average. So that ratio is about a 10. And then you go to the far right, and you say, well, when markets are up more than 10, the average is markets are up 20, and we're up about, you know, 12. And so that's two-thirds. So we get two-thirds of the ups, one-third of the down. That's attractive. If you look in the middle, when markets are more muted, markets are down a little and we're up, and then markets are up, you know, moderate and we're up even better. And so, if we are in a grinding down or a bear market, you feel that we conserve capital and outperform. The next slide is what are the worst drawdowns of global equities since 98? There are eight of those. On average, all eight is down about 23%, and we're down a few percent on average, about 2.3%. So that's about 10% of the down capture if you only take just the worst cumulative measurement periods. So starting on the far left, you have the global financial crisis, and we were down 19%. Obviously, the worst period ever. And then the only period where we were up was when it was a great long-short equity environment in 2000. So currently, through August, global equities are down about 9, and we're down 1. So we just want to give you perspective. The final slide is about the long-term time horizon, but also always upgrading the portfolio about 10% on average. We like our partners, but we do have opportunities to improve it. And there's some statistics you can read at the same time. I'll just... Any questions?
Okay, great. Let me quickly kind of give a broader overview of the private portfolio on page 59. 72 in diligent. We began the fiscal year with $7.2 billion in private investments. We ended the year at $8.3 billion. And really that increase is due to an increase in net asset value. If you look in the middle, the calls were about $1.8 billion, the distributions were about $1.7 billion. So the increase in the net asset value is only $100 million. It was $1 billion of increase due to returns. If you look at the returns, That venture book, I said 51% earlier, this is 53.5%, is what that book returned. The real estate book was up 20% for the year, the private book. The developed country book is up 12%. A lot of that is in our lower middle market. Scott Bingham will tell us a little bit more about that later. I mentioned we committed about $3.1 billion, so our unfunded commitments went from 4.8 to 6.1. Overall, our private investment book returned 13.4%. On the next page, as you know, we began being more active co-investments a few years ago. We have now made, on the far right, in the middle, since inception, we have committed to 50 co-investments, $1.1 billion. $850 million of that has actually been invested. We've had $196 million return. That's on the bottom right. And the book is currently marked at $981 million. So even though we're very early in the program, we've realized an unrealized return of 23% per year, 1.4 times our capital. As Susan mentioned, we've done our first co-investment in the long-only book, and we've also got a co-investment in the hedge book, which I'm thinking is Argentina. Yeah, the co-investment in the hedge fund book. Yeah. And we see a lot of activity, and we're clear about expanding our relationship with our most trusted partners when the dynamics are right, when they've kind of taken all of a investment they can put into their fund, and then there's just more left over.
Yeah, and I guess that's a question. So you've got this co-invest. How do you do that on the public and on the hedge fund side? Why aren't you just thrown in the fund?
Well,
and are there any fees associated with the co-invest?
So why don't you all describe the two co-investments, how we structure.
Sure. So for the Ashley co-invest, separate vehicle, the fees are discounted to the main fund. And then the co-invest is netting.
Not go out and just buy the securities. We did contract with our partner for them to buy the securities. They manage it. We do pay them a fee.
And those are publicly traded securities?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Right.
So the fund usually takes its full position, and you need to serve that first. And then the manager says, I really love this thing and would do more, but I have concentration limits. They call a few clients they're close to, and if it's a really good idea that we think is better than hiring, you know, another manager or adding more capital to their main fund, then we'll go into a vehicle that they manage. Because it is their idea, and they might be compensated.
And if we just did it on our own, they wouldn't share the ideas with us. And then, you know, it's not just buying, we got to know who to sell.
So on the hedge funds, if you've got 20 securities, long, short, whatever, are you... You've got actual investment in all 20 of those that are sidecarred out?
Well, we own the entire flagship
that's
fund.
That's the main fund.
Right.
On the co-investment, this was
the Argentina co-invest was a handful of securities to diversify the risk across the capital structure. But usually it's sort of, you know, the manager's, you know, 5 or 10 best ideas or sometimes.
Okay. This is a real competitive advantage if we can attract those kinds of co-invests with these top-notch managers.
And what we're trying to do is take the advantage of our network effect and partner with such great people using our heft. You know, we're an important partner of theirs. And, being flexible,
some little small endowment's not going to get this up.
They never get the call. They wouldn't have the capital.
Okay. Thank you.
There's
really no changes on the ITF, and I can go through the contracts if you'd like, but I don't think there's anything dramatic there. You want to plow through for another 15 minutes? I think we can do it in about 15, 20 minutes.
How about 10?
I think we can. Well, we'll see.
Okay, let's run.
Okay, next tab, tab for you, TIMCO update, page 3 and 4, in paper 81 and 82. This is our new org chart. You would note, we have gone, this is the first time we've used two pages instead of one page for our org chart. We are growing. We have had some reorganizations on the investment side where Scott Bigham and focusing on lower middle markets. Used to report to Linda, report to Mark Warner, and Pat Pace in healthcare, and Lawrence Rimpo in technology are now also reporting to Mark Schoberg. See, we've got some open positions. If we turn to page 5, 83 in Diligent, just on our budget, where we blew our budget last year was depreciation. We underestimated how much of the capitalized technology would actually be expensed. So it's a non-cash item, but we did blow it. We were kind of better than budget on most other categories. We spent just a little bit more on travel and on executive search. We spent a little more on that. What I'd like to ask Uche to do, some of his colleagues, is to give you a quick update on technology. I think I gave him 10 minutes, so I think we've got 7. Make this quick.
Good morning. Trends are running as usual for technology. The big update we have for you is on our investment support system. As you can see, our site can be found on tab 4, starting on page 6 of the workbook, and page 84 of Diligent. I'll give you a progress report on our investment support system, and my colleague Ammon will give you details of our document management initiative, and Cal from the public practice group will give you a demonstration of how our investment analysts use our Excel tool. Our document management system is largely done. We're already using the results of that to create a document alongside numbers and like that. Data management is an ongoing effort. It's the tool we use to aggregate data from multiple sources and pipe directly into our Excel tool. You see a demonstration from Carl on that shortly. Relationship management system, while we continue to make progress on that, we've come to the conclusion that our current partner is not sufficient for our needs. But before we switch and move to the new partner, we're willing to take a pause and revalidate our vision. Technology has moved on. We've hired some more folks in the technology group. We have enhanced capabilities, and we want to have that feature in our new development efforts going forward. We started the project mid-2013 with a budget estimate of $3.5 million, and over 3 years. Right now, we're just over two years in. We spent $2.5 million. We estimate, subject to our validation and validation of the estimates as well, that it's probably going to take another $1.5 million over the next 12 to 18 months. With that, I'll hand you over to Harmony.
Thank you, Jay. The document management team was formed in February of this year, composed of Rosa Berman, Maureen Shea, Lindsay Oveda, as well as myself. Three of us work part-time on this particular endeavor and work on other projects across the team. Rosa, our senior document specialist, leverages 10 years of experience managing the documents for the management team, where they built out quite a few processes that we leverage for this team. Our first primary objective that we want to accomplish with this particular team was to really institutionalize the document management process at UTIMCO. As we become more integrated across this certain set of best practices with document naming, funded investment, firm naming was really required for us to move more efficiently. Secondly, as we've added investment staff, I think we've hired about 500 people in the last year. You'd have to ask about the exact numbers. We really have had more documents coming into UTIMCO. So backlogs were starting to form, and the document management team successfully was able to remediate currently as the business analyst on the document management team, leveraging my skills as well as Lindsay, who spends half of her time testing the investment support system. We feel like we can provide feedback to the IT team and really be the go-to source for training for staff across UTMGO. The next two slides really go over, or the next three slides go over a little more detail on those objectives, but I wanted to point you to
why don't we skip that, in the interest of time. These guys have done an incredible job working off our backlog, keeping us current, and they've totally re-engineered our process for how documents come in and how many people touch them. There was confusion, redundancy. They've just done a great job. But yeah, this is worth a little demo because this is like real stuff here.
Sure. So I'm going to take a seat.
Kyle's an analyst on the public equity.
And navigate. So we live in spreadsheets, so this is where I feel most comfortable. So really quickly, this will give you an idea of how IDM functions and what it looks like in the spreadsheet. So basically, you can see on the left-hand side here, we just have a short list of inputs. And basically, really quickly, we can build a simple IDM formula. And spit out a result. So this is a one-month return for February 2015, and just by denoting the manager, we can pull that data point. Now, what's really powerful about IDM is that by inputting that formula once, we can now apply that to different cells and spit out multiple pieces of information. So you can kind of think about this as operating leverage, where you're basically doing the work up front, you're doing it once, and then you can apply it to multiple different scenarios. A second example, really quick, is just to show, since I'm an analyst on the public markets team, really quickly we can populate a spreadsheet showing our managers in the book, and then also 80 data points, just like that. So you can see the power. Now, quickly, just from our shoes as analysts, typically we update spreadsheets like this on a monthly basis. Every month we get new NAVs, we get new performance. Previously, we need to go to multiple different sources, reach out, pull the data, manually extract it, put it in these spreadsheets. You can see how that's pretty repetitive. With IDM, what we can do is simply change one input, the date, hit enter.
So that we're pulling from Burgess, Salesforce, ISS, and Mellon, and giving one single syntax to the business, and they don't have to understand all the understandings of how it works.
The power of this is just continuous integration. Resources come online, tied in, it's just
really impressive.
Yeah, it is. Question. So what do your portfolio managers think about it? I mean, they're the users of the data, right? And it's great to have WhizBang IT.
Kyle is on the portfolio.
So you, hey, Susan, what do you think about this?
I think it's great because it means that Kyle can spend less of his time, pulling the return number from the newsletter and more thinking about
how to look at the prospects. How much time do you see these stages
take? So if I had to go out to all the sources to populate the spreadsheet that I was just in with our portfolio, that might be 30 minutes to an hour. And you can see right there, it's changing the date. And
this is replicated across all the analysts and attribute.
So, Susan, you're not letting Kyle leave earlier, right? Just giving him higher value added tests before.
Well, impressive. Really great stuff. Thank you guys for your work.
Okay, Bruce, you want to take a break here? So, lunchtime, let's recess, a brief recess for lunch, and reconvene maybe in about 20 to 30 minutes. 20 would be better than 30.
Yes, sir.
So, all right. Okay. All right.